Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Before we start the show, this episode is going to feature an interview with a prominent leader at an industry partner, Medtronix. Because of that, we would like to disclose our conflict of interest at the start of the episode for this discussion. Dr. Porter is a chief medical officer at Medtronix, and I am a consultant for Intuitive Surgery. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Knife. I'm James Jung, a minimally invasive surgeon at Duke University. And I'm joined today by Joey Leff, one of our research residents at Duke University. So when we talk about minimally invasive surgery today, the landscape of things, we're not talking about just the future that's coming. We're talking about a shift that's already here. The robotics platform has moved from a nice to have to a dominant force across many procedures and hospitals. We're really at an inflection point with robotic platform. And to help us unpack what's driving that change and what's coming next, we're thrilled to be joined by Dr. Jim Porter, Chief Medical Officer of Robotics and Digital Technologies at Medtronix, and a pioneering minimally invasive urology surgeon. So Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, James. Really a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so before we get to the meat of the conversation with Dr. Porter, foreground our discussion, Joey, why don't you talk a bit about the paper for discussion today, which is entitled The Death of Laparoscopy.
Absolutely. This is a retrospective observational study using ACS NISQIP data from 2012 to 2023 to look at utilization of laparoscopic versus robotic technique for a variety of operations. This is an update to the study of the same name published in 2021. The article touts several benefits of robotic surgery, including enhanced dexterity, precision, control, visualization, and integration opportunity with AI and telesurgery, with laudable goals such as improving patient outcomes, shortening the learning curve, and expanding access to complex procedures. Essentially, they found that where robotic surgery already has an edge over laparoscopy is in urologic procedures like prostatectomy, nephrectomy, and cystectomy. Its expansion has only continued. In some surgeries, such as proctectomy, pancreatectomy, and esophagectomy, robotics is surpassing laparoscopy for the first time, but an open approach remains very common. Finally, where laparoscopy remains dominant as the minimally invasive approach, such as in colectomy and hepatectomy, robotic surgery is still expected to surpass it by the end of 2026. In other words, robotic surgery is the future of minimally invasive surgery.
Joey, I think that's a fantastic summary of this article. I'm really thrilled that Jim has joined this episode because not only is Jim a chief medical officer for a major player in this robotic platform and robotic industry, but you've had a long journey in MIS and especially adoption of robotic platform from very early on. So Jim, I'd love to kind of hear from you about your journey, your personal journey, your decision to adopt robotic platforms so early in your career and its trajectory.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I think I was really blessed to have a career that lined up with technological advance in surgery. A lot of people have careers where not a lot of things change, but there's been some big shifts in my career. So 30 years ago, I started doing surgery, first as an open surgeon. And then early on, I went to Germany to do a fellowship in laparoscopy. So I learned laparoscopy in Europe, brought that back to my department at the University of Washington in Seattle, and then did laparoscopy for many years, did over 1,000 procedures, started doing laparoscopic prostatectomy, kidney surgery, kidney donor surgeries. And I was very facile at it, but it was challenging. It was very, very hard. And it was very hard to teach because it took me quite a long time, an extended learning curve to learn the skills of laparoscopy because you're working in a 2D environment. I think to me, that was the major limitation was not having depth that you would normally have with open surgery. We were doing surgery and then the robot came along and actually my first robot was not the robot that's currently out there. My first robot was a robot called Zeus from a company called Computer Motion. So there was competition back in the early 2000s. It was Computer Motion and Da Vinci. And Zeus was a three-arm robot with an open console. It was essentially three arm-controlling robots that were called ESOP on its own, but with three together, they were called Zeus. We had this. I was part of the FDA trial for Computer Motion for prostatectomy. Mm-hmm. And about halfway through the trial, the company called me and said, "Trial's over. We've been purchased by Da Vinci. Thanks for your help. Good luck. Good luck. But it, to me, it was actually a blessing, because Da Vinci had, I think, a better robot. They had a better platform. I was very happy to get on it. So at that point, I started doing robotics. So that was early 2003. I used their first robot, their three-arm standard robot that they first came out with, and then went to the forearm. From the forearm, went to the S, the SI, the XI, the single port. So I have a single port Da Vinci as well. So yeah, I've had a long run of the technology. So I'm pretty versed in how it's gone. It's been a great thing for my career and a great thing for my patients.
Mm-hmm. I mean, your area of expertise in urology, especially in prostatectomy, has really been the leading case use for this robotic platform. And really, I think if we read our paper that Joey had presented, really robotic platform is winning, and it's by far, right? So from your vantage point, why has robotic surgery crossed that threshold from adjunct to the default or standard in so many procedures? What are some of the real advantages?
Yeah. Well, I think the drivers, first of all, it became apparent to the public that surgery could be done a different way. You did not need a big subcostal incision for a gallbladder surgery. You didn't need to be in the hospital for a week after that. So when that started, and then it went to GYN and hysterectomy, and then it went to other specialties, the public knew that they did not have to have the same pain and suffering recovery that you do with open surgery. That was one driver. The second driver was that laparoscopy was very hard. It was working in a 2D environment with straight instruments, and you had limited mobility. You didn't have your fingers and your wrist and your hand. You know, you were doing things with limitations. And amazingly, the surgeons who were doing laparoscopy overcame those limitations and were able to do essentially almost everything that was done open. Mm-hmm. And that was just a credit to, I think, perseverance and surgeons and the technology. The technology in laparoscopy advanced as well. Some of the companies like Medtronic that is advancing robotics, they were pushing some of the laparoscopic technologies. So there's been this dance between industry and surgery for a long time to help improve minimally invasive surgery. So what happened was laparoscopy was hard, and then the robot came along and it really changed the difficulty. So first of all, you went to 3D, and to me, 3D view is probably the best benefit of robotics. I can see things with the robot that I couldn't even see with my own eyes because of the magnification. And then you had wristed instruments from Intuitive. And then you had an ergonomic position, which was superior to laparoscopy, which was standing at attention for 5 to 6 hours. I mean, I was young when I started doing lap, but my back and my neck were a problem for a long time. And then I sat down and everything changed. So I think it was really the surgeons who saw that they could do better surgery with the robot than they can laparoscopically. I did laparoscopic partial nephrectomy as another procedure. And the partial nephrectomies I could do were pretty simple, pretty middle of the road. Now with the robot, I can pretty much do any laparoscopic partial nephrectomy that anybody does open. And that's because of technology. It allows you to do things that you just couldn't do laparoscopically.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like even though you were an early adopter, even of laparoscopy, and very skilled in that, you still felt that switching over to the robot sort of broadened the patient population, set of conditions you could operate on. Is that fair?
Yeah. I could do better surgery, and I could do it with less impact to me. And I think the other thing that drove this is that when I was doing laparoscopy, like, for example, the prostatectomy trial, in the early 2000s, there were maybe 20 or 30 surgeons in the U.S. who could do laparoscopic prostatectomy. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if the robot hadn't come along, it would have probably been 20 or 30 surgeons for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. What the robot did is it expanded the surgeon pool who could do MIS. There were surgeons who were never going to do laparoscopic surgery, but those same surgeons now are doing robotics because of the way the technology allows them to do MIS.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, with the improving ergonomics, the improving patient perception, broadening capability, democratization of this technology and ability to use it, I'm curious how you perceive how the hospital economics of this have evolved, right? The comparison of clinical outcomes and sort of all of these factors that kind of have plus and minus to both sides of them as new technologies are adopted, how all of that's moved forward with the switch to the robot.
Yeah. Well, I think economics is a great question when it comes to robotics, because I think there's a great example about how economics impact robotic surgery. And that is, if you consider the United States and everything outside the United States, because the economics outside the United States are very different. And because they're different, robotic surgery is different outside the United States. Mm-hmm. The adoption is not the adoption we have in the US. The number of surgeons doing laparoscopy is still quite high outside mm-hmm. the United States. And they're quite skilled and they're quite good. Laparoscopy I did in the late 90s, early 2000s is not the laparoscopy that's happening right now. It's a very different type of surgery and it's very high level. So what we see outside the United States is some places robotic surgery only happens if either the patient pays for it or they have a pool of money that goes towards robotics. And after that pool of money has expired, they're doing laparoscopy or they're doing open surgery. Mm. That's not the way it is in the US. In the US, we have pretty much unlimited access to funds for robotic surgery. And that's why the US is the largest robotic market in the world. It's where most robotic surgeries have started. And it's where we've seen the greatest advances in robotic surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can certainly attest to that. Having trained at the University of Toronto, Canadian trained, the adoption of robotic platforms, even in the high resource setting like Toronto, has been quite limited because of the ability or lack of ability to pay for the add-on costs and, you know, the lack of training and so forth. So if we were to limit this rise of robotics in the U.S., Jim, why do you think that robotics winning in terms of, is this a technological story that the advancement in technology is so good that this is the dominant force? Or is it the new emerging workforce that's maybe more getting used to the robotic platform and is being retained in their robotic practice? Or is it the lack of laparoscopic training or advanced laparoscopic training that's enabling the robotic to be used more and more frequently and be a dominant player?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, again, it's unfortunately, it's not one answer. There's several when it comes to this. But I think we have a situation in the US where because robotics was supported from a very early time, we just have more and more access. So when you get a robot in the hospital for the urologist, all of a sudden the general surgeon has access to it. And all of a sudden the GYN surgeon has access to it. And that's going to grow markets. That's going to grow procedures that were never intended to be robotic. All of a sudden they have access to it. I mean, think about how hard it is to do a Whipple, right? I mean, now we're doing Whipples with the robot. And that's a technological feat. And that's because the robot's in the operating room. Nobody is going to buy a robot for a Whipple program. Nobody's going to do that. That happened because they had access to the robot. So I think that's a factor. I also think the company was very good at convincing surgeons that they needed a robot to do surgery. And I think mm-hmm. when you get on that robot and you're a laparoscopic surgeon, you believe it. You believe that this is a much better way to do surgery. And many aspects of it are. But I don't think we look at that critically. I think there are procedures where you can do it well laparoscopically and patients have the same outcome, then the economics are very, very different laparoscopically. I think there are some procedures where the outcomes were better. For prostatectomy, for example, you know, we saw blood loss change dramatically. We saw catheter dwell time change dramatically. Length of stay change dramatically. These were real, and these were without randomized trials. Those were real changes. So I think outcomes also drove a lot of this as well. So, you know, I think we're still going to see more and more robotics happen. But I think at some point, what has been true is that every time the robot has gotten better, the cost of care has increased as well. And that's a reality. And we need to someday address that. So the other reality is that when you have one dominant vendor for a product, you're never going to see the cost change. So that's why we need competition, and we're seeing it. And that's why I'm involved in bringing competition to the robotic space. And I look forward to it.
This is very insightful, and you've given us a lot to unpack. And I think this will serve as a roadmap for the next few questions that we have. So the first question is, the opponents of robotic platform adoption, and my colleagues in Canada still argue about this a lot, is that when you look at the study evidence, when you look at the outcomes, thinking about the gallbladder bile duct injury outcomes, comparing robot to laparoscopic, the outcomes tend to be equivalent, or sometimes there are in some procedures like higher rates of adverse outcomes in robots. So do you think this migration to robot in the US is justified, like without that overwhelmingly better outcomes with robots?
Yeah, I think if you were going on evidence alone, you would have a hard time justifying the growth. Mm-hmm. The evidence has been, I mean, in many cases, it's been against robotics, to be honest. It's not been pro-robotics. I mean, we have GYN oncology trial. We have a hernia trial from 2020 where laparoscopy was superior. We don't have many trials saying robotics is better. So if it's based on evidence, you would question the growth. But as you know, there's more factors that influence surgical practice. Mm-hmm. And I believe we're in a place now where we are going to start to listen to what surgeons say about their bodies and their practice and their careers. We're in a new age with surgery. I know you talk about that on your podcast, but I think surgeons are going to stop just suffering in silence. And mm-hmm. we've done that for generations, and now we realize that that has a toll, and I think the robot helps with that. I think it really is going to extend people's careers. I think they're going to be able to do more and do it more efficiently. So I think that's another factor that's driving this. I think that goes beyond evidence, and it's very hard to show that in an evidence-based way. I also believe, and again, probably one of the hardest things we've had to show it in MIS is what happens to the patients outside the hospital. We can do a lot of data analysis inside of a hospital, but to show that somebody's really benefiting and getting back to work sooner, improving their quality of life outside the hospital, nobody's done that well. That's almost absent in the literature. So I think that's something that I think it's there. We just haven't been able to prove it. So evidence is important, but it's not the full story.
Yeah, I wonder too, as a trainee, when I think about learning new procedures and we're learning them open and we're learning them laparoscopically and we're learning them robotically, the teaching capacity of the dual console, the facility with using the robotic arms compared to trying to manipulate laparoscopic instruments as its own set of learning skills on top of the procedural, the anatomy of the case, progressing the case and all those things. I wonder if at teaching institutions, the educational component has pushed some folks one way or the other.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt to that. I think it's a premier teaching platform as well. It's not just a surgical platform, it's a teaching platform. And we all, you know, you're surgeons, you understand this. Teaching has to happen. Our medicine's over. So teaching is something we have to do, but we have to do it well and we have to do it responsibly. And I think the robot really allows that because it allows a very clear line between the surgeon and the trainee. And that line can be very quickly, you know, moved if needed for the patient's benefit. So I think when you consider everything we do is video-based, it can be captured, it can be reviewed. I think reviewing video is probably one of the major strengths of robotic surgery. I think it's how people climb the learning curve faster. I think it's how we disseminate good techniques is through video. There can also be bad techniques disseminated through video. Mm-hmm. I've seen that as well, so we have to be careful there. The robot itself is just easier for a trainee to manipulate than a laparoscopic instrument. I just believe it is. I mean, think about what you have between you and the patient with a robot. You have a computer, which is taking your movements, refining them, making them better. Think about the tremor removal, the scaling a robot provides to get rid of tremor. Think about how important that is, how precise you can be without that tremor. I mean, I know I sound like an ad for robotics, but it's a real
thing. Yeah.
I mean, it makes you better.
Yeah.
And if you can see better and you can move better, you're going to do better surgery.
Yeah, I think this brings up a real interesting, somewhat philosophical question and notion in our training of our residents and trainees is that, like you said, Jim, laparoscopic, especially advanced laparoscopic movements, maneuvers are very technically challenging and demands lots of practice times, focus, and a lot of fine movements. As a bariatric surgeon, some of them could be an osmotic closure with sutures, all those things. And I'm sure that's the same with the prostatectomies as well. That I feel that the current residents today are much better on robotic platforms than doing it in laparoscopic. And some of the opponents of this will say, well, are we expecting less from trainees? Like, are we graduating trainees that are achieving less of the standard than the generation before? And then on the flip side, what I would think is, so what? If the clinical outcomes for the patients are equivalent, whether the trainees are able to do laparoscopic advanced movements or do it more easily on robotic platforms, you know, even if the skill sets that are required may be less on robot, if we're training graduating surgeons that are achieving the same or even better outcomes, then does it really matter that we're training them all these very challenging laparoscopic moves?
Yeah, I would say things change in surgery. I mean, we see this all the time. And you mentioned the standard. Well, the standard changes over time because the tools you have, what you're doing changes. I mean, there's a lot of examples of this in surgery. For example, early in my career, people used to talk about doing kidney stones used to be done with open surgery, big flank incisions or a Gibbs incision or these incisions that every stone, ureteral stone, kidney stone, all done open. And then when minimally invasive techniques came to remove stones, the term is called endourology. I mean, the open surgeons thought people were going to die, that everybody without the ability to open patients, fix things with open surgery, then there would be a very considerable decline in the way we treat patients. And it didn't happen. It just didn't happen. Nobody opens anybody for kidney stone surgery anymore. That was standard of care 40, 50 years ago. But that story came and went. So as our tools evolve, as things get better, what we do evolves, and the standard should evolve with that. So look, surgery is dangerous. You can't ignore the danger of surgery. You have to be ready to do things. And we all know MIS is limited access to the abdomen. But we can do a lot of things, MIS, to deal with problems that you would not believe you could do even 15 years ago. So I think modern training has to be in line with the technology, and that's where we are right now.
Hi, OUBTK fans. It's Scott here with a word from our sponsors, and that's FIGS. And so it takes heart to build bodies that break records. Over the last 6 years, a team of incredible healthcare professionals did what most people thought was impossible. They rebuilt the body of legendary Olympian Lindsey Vonn after a series of devastating injuries that forced her into early retirement. Now she's headed to the 2026 Winter Games, ready to break records once again. This February in Milan, Lindsey's team and the entire USA medical team will be wearing FIGS. You can rock their official uniform too. The new Team USA collection from FIGS is engineered with FiberX, their most durable fabric yet. FiberX is setting the new gold standard for high-performance scrub wear. It's lightweight, breathable, and ultra-resilient, and of course, the styles come in red, white, and blue. Check out the limited Team USA collection and get a 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com. That's WEARFIGS.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
I want to briefly ask you about on the trainer's perspective. So we're seeing generation of laparoscopic heavy or laparoscopic only MIS surgeons who are training a generation of mostly robotic trained trainees. And then I hear at conferences, they feel that a little bit of dissatisfaction that they're not appropriately training the same standards of trainees as before. And they wonder if they could continue performing laparoscopic surgery at an academic teaching hospitals with the new set of trainees. What's your comment around that? And what do you see in your colleagues who are reaching those status?
So, yeah, I think obviously everything, if the trainee is going to change, the trainer has to change. We had the same argument for prostatectomy back in the 2000s, 20 years ago. We had the same things. The open surgeons who had built their whole careers on open surgery, they were very much against robotic prostatectomy. They were questioning the safety of it, questioning the oncologic capability of robotic surgery. We got pushback, and we learned prostatectomy from the open surgeons. That's who started prostatectomy. So our goal was to recreate that, which we did. So we heard a lot from that group. And then over time, the outcomes were published and we could see where these outcomes were going. And we saw they were better. We were getting better outcomes. And this gets back to a point I made earlier. There was, again, 20 great open surgeons doing prostatectomy in the U.S. And they were all at academic centers and they were the kings of prostatectomy. And if you wanted a prostatectomy at a high volume place, that's where you went. Well, there's 500 of those people now in robotics. We've expanded the pool of people who can do really good prostatectomy. And again, that's the technology along with the learnings we've had over the years to make this better. So I think trainers have to adapt to what they're doing. Look, there's still great laparoscopic surgery that happens. I go outside the United States all the time and I see some of the best laparoscopic surgery. I think, wow, that guy is as good as I am with sticks. And it's amazing what they can do. But only a few can do that. And we got to think about how we're going to treat our population with a few experts. We're just not going to be able to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think you give the haters a lot to think about when it comes to what is the future direction. How have we seen this time loop before with the introduction of new technology into surgery? I do wonder, is the title of that article that we brought up in the beginning, The Death of Laparoscopy, is the death of laparoscopy a little bit of hyperbole? You talk about internationally, we're seeing it. Obviously, we're still seeing it here. But when we think about our lap coleys, our lap appies, all these things, do you see everything, even the most common general surgery operation, the most common urologic operation, moving to the robot eventually? Do you think it's just a matter of time? Or do you think that that corner of the market's going to persist for us learning laparoscopy and practicing it, even in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think about it quite a bit because I think there is an inflection point for the benefits of robotics versus the cost of robotics. I think there's the curves crossed on certain procedures. And I don't want to get people excited because I know that people are pretty evangelistic about what they do, but honestly, outcomes with open surgery are really good. And the patients go home the same time. And if you're talking about developing a care pathway based on a few milligrams of morphine difference in a study, then you're probably missing the bigger picture on this. So
sure.
Again, I'm MIS. I don't think every procedure is going to see the same benefit. I think the benefit varies depending on the procedure. We haven't had to do this, but eventually we may have to start thinking about our resources in a broader sense. You know, like we have limited resources or we have restrained resources and we have to think about how we're best going to use that. So yeah, it's a tricky question, tricky challenge.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a bit about the robotic surgery market and, you know, as it's been really dominated by the incumbent. And obviously, there are many emerging players in this market, including Medtronic. So as you represent Medtronic, how does Medtronic think about entering and competing in a space where the surgeon habits and hospital infrastructure, the training pipelines have really been deeply entrenched?
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge. There's no question. Fortunately, the U.S. is not our first go-round with our robot, with Hugo. We've done this outside the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, and we have seen kind of what that looks like, bringing a new robot into an established robotic market, not as penetrated as the U.S., for sure, but still very penetrated. And we've seen the challenges involved there, but it turns out people are very interested in choice. They're very interested in alternatives. That's why there's not one car out there or one anything out there. There's multiple, and people like alternatives. They like choice. And I think in robotics, the choice we offer has some very unique offerings that the current robot does not. And I think people are very interested to see how that would impact what they do surgically. The interesting thing is you really don't know some technologies, how they're going to pan out until they're applied. I think that's an unfortunate thing about technology because you wish you could know that right away, but that's the reality. And I think what we're seeing is the application of the tool in a way that we never really thought of. And the same went for Intuitive, by the way. I mean, they started in cardiac surgery. That was their first market, was they were going after cardiac and it didn't go well. And they landed on the prostate. Prostate was really what drove their growth in their market. So that's what happens with technology. Things are not always as predictable as you would hope. But getting to your question, I think choice is a big driver. I think people want that. I think people want competition. They know what competition can do to cost. They know what competition can do to improving technologies. Certain companies are going to offer certain things based on other things that they do. So for example, Medtronic, we not only do robotics, we do laparoscopy, we do open surgery. We do a lot, we do interventional surgeries. We do a lot of different things. And so based on our background and our portfolio and our strengths, we can offer certain things on the robot that others may not.
Yeah, I'm curious, thinking about what the Hugo does offer uniquely, even at face value, right? Even when you see the machine and thinking about how that differs and seeing these arms that are separate and can be manipulated and moved completely separately from each other, such that you see some even interesting reverse positioning, or a hand that maybe we wouldn't initially would have thought is the left is now the right. I'm thinking of this rectal surgery paper that came out recently. Do you see some of these features that are different, that are bringing something different to the market, maybe applying to specific populations or specific surgeries? Or how do you see that differentiating the system? For, I imagine this is never going to be an individual surgeon buying one of these things, right? It's like a hospital system investing in another system. So how do you think about those sort of differences?
Yeah. Well, the way I think about it is, you just answered my question, which is, when a hospital buys a robot, they don't buy for one specialty anymore. They buy for multiple specialties. And every specialty has a very different need when it comes to robotics. They have different access needs. They're in different parts to the abdomen. They might have to be all over the abdomen. So when you are tethered to a boom, like the Da Vinci, your arms are limited in how far they can really go. They can go far, but they can't go as far as a modular robot, where you can put these arms and they're not tethered to each other, so they're independent, which means that you can put these arms in places that you just can't reach with a boom robot. So what does that mean? Let's say you're doing a left colectomy and you've got to go from the splenic flexor all the way down, you know, into the pelvis. All of a sudden, with the Hugo, we don't see any problem doing that. In fact, we have surgeons now discovering ways how to do this with three arms instead of four arms. I mean, because they can really move the arms in ways that you just can't move with a boom robot. And so I think what Hugo offers is, if you want to stay in one place, the pelvis, and do something, Hugo can do that. If you want to cover the entire abdomen and do many different types of surgeries, you can do that. So that's where I think the choice matters here. The choice allows surgeons to really expand what they can do and allows hospitals to offer many different robotic specialties.
Thank you so much. As a resident, I love the DV5 because that's what I've gotten to play with. So when am I going to get to know the Hugo, do you think, more broadly on the market?
Well, we're available for urology in the U.S. We're starting our launch soon. We haven't started it yet, but we are getting ready. I think, as you know, once a robot's in the hospital, it's fair game. So you never know. You might be on it soon.
Amazing.
Perfect. Jim, that's really fantastic. Unfortunately, this is, like, I think all the time we have for this episode, but I think we could just go on talk for hours about the robotic, really revolution of our minimally invasive surgical techniques, where Tronix and you are playing a big role. I think just to summarize our discussion with you, Jim, you know, we talked about how the prevalence of robotic surgery is increasing over the last few years, and that's supported by some clinical evidence as well as being able to perform complex tasks in certain anatomy, and also supported by surgeon ergonomics as well as what patients wanted. On the flip side, we talked about some equivalent or some inferior clinical outcomes demonstrated in some of the studies, and the cost that's associated with adoption of these robotic platforms, which may limit widespread adoption in certain parts of the world outside of the United States. Jim, as we kind of wrap up our discussion, what is something that you want the listeners of Behind the Knife, who are usually surgeons, trainees, and people in healthcare, to take away from our discussion today?
Yeah, I think the robot has changed surgery forever. I think that is clear. I think I agree with the paper is a bit hyperbole. I don't think laparoscopy's dead, but it's definitely on life support. And I think we're going to continue to see more robots. We're going to continue to see dedicated robots. Right now, we're talking about soft tissue multi-port robots, but there's single port robots, there's endoluminal robots. There's now going to be robots made for a specific place and a specific job. And that's exciting to me because that is the next stage in robotics. We're going to now develop functional specific robots that will, again, improve what we do. So I think it's, I think we're in an exciting time. And I think everybody should really look forward to where this is going to take us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Jim, for your time. Thank you all for joining us. Go get those hours on a simulator and dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple, iOS, and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.